Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh DeHaas, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
And I'm Christine Van Gine, the CCF's litigation director.
I'm Joanna Barron, executive director of the CCF. And in today's episode, I'll fill you in on the latest developments in the ongoing debate and the latest chapter in this debate over the notwithstanding clause.
I'll explain why we're heading to Parliament tomorrow to testify against a Liberal bill that would try to make a taxpayer-funded court challenges program permanent.
And we'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some legal opinions that didn't quite land. But first, I want to talk a bit about the Trudeau government's proposed Countering Foreign Interference Act, and one particular provision outlawing sabotage of critical infrastructure that's getting a lot of attention online. So, before I get into the sabotage provision, I just want to say there's lots in this act to like, and my main criticism of the bill at large is just, you know, what took them so long. For example, it's going to create a foreign influence registry, which should make it easier to figure out which foreign governments are lobbying our MPs. The act would also create a new criminal offense for political interference, including where people threaten to harm the relatives of Canadian citizens abroad, obviously China, which is a huge problem. And finally, it would create a new Foreign Influence Transparency Commissioner who would have strong powers to investigate and report on alleged foreign interference. So, of course, it's worth pointing out that this bill landed right when Justice Marie Hogue released her report on foreign interference after the commission that the Liberals had dragged their feet for months and months to try to avoid. And that commission made pretty clear that the Liberals turned a blind eye to China's interference in the last two elections, which we all know now cost the Conservatives at least a handful of seats. And I don't want to get sidetracked by delving too deeply into the Hogue report, but pretty stunning revelations out of it. For example, the fact that Trudeau knew Han Dong won the nomination race for the Liberals in Don Valley North after loads of Chinese high school students were bussed in from another riding to vote, which, by the way, was perfectly legal and will remain perfectly legal after this act. Also, Trudeau told the commissioner that he didn't unendorse Dong because he was concerned about, quote, the direct electoral consequences. So think about that for a second. There were obvious reasons to be concerned that China was interfering in that nomination race, and Trudeau didn't want to say anything because he didn't want to lose the seat. I don't want to get too sidetracked into that Foreign Interference Commission, but I do want to focus on this provision related to sabotage, because Mariko Walsh from The Globe reached out to us yesterday. And, you know, I think that's partly because this particular provision didn't really seem to fit very well in the rest of the act. So obviously sabotage, whether it's blowing things up or, you know, hacking things, is already illegal, but this bill would create a new criminal code offense where a person interferes with access to essential infrastructure or causes essential infrastructure to be lost, inoperable, unsafe, or unfit. And this is really important, does so with the intent to endanger safety, security, or the defense of Canada, or cause a serious health or safety risk to the public. So the act would define essential infrastructure extremely broadly to include things like transportation infrastructure, health services infrastructure, food supply and food services infrastructure, government operations infrastructure, financial infrastructure, and any other infrastructure the minister prescribes. It doesn't include interfering with access to essential infrastructure while participating in, quote, advocacy, protest, or dissent, where the person doesn't intend to cause any of those serious harms. So I wondered why The Globe is interested in this, and I went on Twitter, and there's a thread there that's gone kind of viral from a woman named Andy Lee, who is a self-described investigative journalist. And she has a theory on why the Liberals, included this sabotage provision. And I think this theory is, you know, pretty out there. Her theory is that the sabotage provision is a diabolical attempt by the Liberals to, quote, soften up the existing sabotage law and quote, let activists who commit acts of sabotage in the name of protesting off the hook. And obviously she's referring to this saving provision. She says, now, who do we know that might be planning to commit acts of sabotage that might benefit from this? And then she links to a post from a group called Students for Queer Liberation that's planning blockades across North America in support of the Palestinians. So I can see why Ms. Lee is a little bit suspicious here, because it is kind of odd to put a sabotage provision in a bill on foreign interference. It does kind of stand out. And the creation of this new provision does seem a little suspect to me, but for a whole different reason. So, you know, being charitable, you could say this provision is just an attempt to clarify for the police, prosecutors, and the public that blockading or otherwise interfering seriously with critical infrastructure is unacceptable and it's going to land you in jail. But I find it kind of suspect because of the timing. It lands when the Trudeau government is appealing the decision in January that their use of the Emergencies Act in response to the Freedom Convoy was unlawful. You'll recall that Justice Mosley found that it was unlawful because there were no threats to the security of Canada, and because the illegal activity that was taking place, like the border blockades at Windsor and Coutts, could be and were dealt with effectively using the regular criminal laws. So you'll also recall the government claimed this emergency existed because of, quote, economic security and economic harms, and Justice Mosley said, no, that doesn't count. So my theory is the fact that they're now planning to create this new criminal provision banning interference with things like financial infrastructure and transportation infrastructure, that's, by the way, almost certainly already illegal under other parts of the criminal code, makes me think that this might be just an attempt to try and justify in the court of public opinion their illegal use of the Emergencies Act to suspend rights, claiming that they didn't have the legal tools necessary to stop illegal border blockades that were associated with the convoy. So all that said, I don't actually see anything that's plainly unconstitutional about what they're doing here. To me, criminalizing interference with critical infrastructure where there's an intent to cause serious harms like danger to health and safety is probably constitutional. You know, freedom of expression doesn't include a right to blockade. And the intent that seems to be required here won't be present in most cases. You know, for example, if people block a rail line that delivers propane needed to heat people's homes in the middle of winter, or blocks a port that imports groceries and people can't get fed, and the protesters have intent, they say, you know, we want these people to freeze or starve, maybe you could use this provision. But I think even for most blockades, which are already illegal, this won't be used. So I'm a little bit suspicious of the motives and the timing, but I'm not all that worried about this provision. I don't know, am I wrong here? Like, Joanna, what do you think?
I think it all depends on how loosey-goosey whoever it is, the cops or the government, are going to be with what is critical infrastructure, right? There is some wiggle room in there, as I think you mentioned in your comments to Marika. Like, you could say grocery store is critical infrastructure. I mean, people even suggested, sort of, I mean, certainly the media talked a lot during the convoy, that the Rideau Centre, which is just like a mall, which, by the way, we just got back from Ottawa, and it is always a mall that is flanked by unfortunately homeless people and junkies, and it's just like worse and worse. So it's like critical infrastructure in that it seems to be a home and town square for all of the social ills of Ottawa. Very tragic to see. But anyways, it's the biggest mall in Ottawa. I'm sure it does tons of sales. And it was constantly mentioned that the Rideau Center has been closed for 3 weeks and it's costing millions of dollars in trade. And so I just think it's not, I just wouldn't put it past Canadian police officers or Canadian government officials to make a claim that something inessential was critical infrastructure. But even that, I agree, is a little bit far-fetched. As for the part about this being tackled onto the foreign interference bill, the government just does this all the time. I remember they did it with the provisions of the Elections Act that banned fake news that we successfully challenged a few years ago. Like, this is just government bureaucracies and how they do. I am not in the school of thought. Like, I think the simpler incompetent explanation is the accurate explanation. Apologies to Ms. Andy Lee. What do you think, Christine?
Well, and apologies to Josh. He has his own different conspiracy. And now that we know conspiracy theories on Twitter, I think you needed your own viral thread there, Josh. Why don't you jump on, get those likes and shares.
It's really about the CCF's case.
Yeah, it's all about us. Yeah. My objection is like, I just don't like it when governments enact laws that are duplicative. Like blocking critical infrastructure is already, you already can't do that. We don't need a special law to deal with it. I think that there's probably an element of the government wanting to be perceived as taking action on foreign interference because they've really terribly bungled that file. Like they're getting hammered on this issue with the whole examination into what's been happening, the committees, I guess, in Ottawa that are addressing this, the media coverage revealing how badly handled foreign interference has been by this government. I think they're desperate to be perceived as doing something on this issue. And it's pretty easy to just ban something that's already banned and like say you're doing something. That's a lot easier than actually fixing the difficult problem of Chinese and Indian interference into our domestic election systems. Like that is a really important problem to be addressed, and it's a hard one to address. And I'm not inspired by this, although I do like the main character vibes that you are giving in your conspiracy, Josh, that everything's about us. So I'm into that. Let me turn now to my headline. And my headline is also about you, Josh. You really are the main character this week. So this week you are going to be appearing at the Heritage Committee to talk about a new bill that is sort of quietly working its way through Parliament. It's Bill C-316. And this is a private member's bill. It would entrench or make permanent something called the Court Challenges Program. It would make it a direct piece of legislation by amending the Heritage Act. And, you know, if you're listening, you may be asking, what is the Court Challenges Program and what's wrong with it? Why do Christine, Josh, and Joanna not like it? Well, there are a few problems and they come from a few different perspectives. Basically, what the Court Challenge Program does is it gives taxpayer money to fund particular lawsuits in different areas of law, whether it's human rights under various sections of the Charter, like freedom of expression. You can apply to have taxpayer money fund your lawsuit against the government. And then the other area is in Francophone or Anglophone rights, language rights. So, I mean, from a taxpayer perspective, the government just should not fund lawsuits against its own laws with taxpayer money. That, I think, should be obvious. Instead, you know, if the government has a bad law, they should repeal the law. Or if they think that it's good, if they think their law is right, then they should use their resources to defend the law if they believe in it. But paying to sue yourself just doesn't make any sense. So my gauge on this type of thing about like whether I'm like, what would a regular person think? For me, I usually ask my husband because he's not a super hyper partisan or hyper political person. So the other day I asked him, did you know that the government gives people money that they use to sue the government? Do you know that you can apply to get funding to sue the government and the government will give you that money? And he just burst out laughing. He was like, What is wrong with this country? Like, why on earth would we do that? It is so insane to any regular person that a program like this exists. So aside from it just being crazy to fund something like that, there's another problem with the program, which is that it's basically a political football. It has been tossed or punted back and forth by successive liberal and conservative governments going back to 1978. And that was when the program was first introduced by Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who created it basically as an indirect attack on Quebec's Bill 101 language law. He wanted to attack it indirectly because obviously his government would pay some obvious political price for challenging that law in Quebec. So he didn't want to attack it directly. And he also didn't want to use the disallowance power under our constitution. So, you know, this is not usually the story that is told about the origins of the Court Challenges Act. If you read about the origins of the program, people usually write about it very innocuously. They say it was introduced to help people address language rights issues. But it was a lot more than that. It was Pierre Elliott Trudeau wanting to indirectly use federal government money to attack a provincial law. So big problems there. The program was then expanded by the Mulroney government in 1985, and then it was completely withdrawn in 1992. It was then reinstated by Liberal Prime Minister Jean Chrétien in 1994, and then abolished by Conservative Prime Minister Harper in 2006. And then in 2017, Justin Trudeau's government fully reinstated the program with an annual $5 million budget. So what this private member's bill would do is make the program permanent. It would entrench it into the Court Challenges program, meaning that any future government, like the Pierre Poilievre government, if they are to be formed in the next 18 months or whatever it is, you know, if they want to get rid of it, they would need to pass legislation. And I think entrenching it would be a big mistake. As I've expressed, there's these taxpayer problems. There's this political football issue. There's also this inherent conceptual problem that the government can't hold itself to account by funding litigation against its own policies and laws. Funding for that program is always going to just inherently be politically skewed by the partisanship of the government in power. And we do not get information about which cases are funded, which is also another problem with the program. It's a secret who they actually fund while the litigation's ongoing. But we do know that the Minister of Heritage is the one who appoints the expert panels who decide on whether or not to grant funding to a particular case. And Professor Ian Brody from the University of Calgary has pointed out in some of his criticisms of this private member's bill that once a government decides which groups should get funding to launch court cases, rights litigation ceases to be a grassroots ground-up process of holding government to account. And if you just even look up who sits on this committee, these seven-person committees who are appointed by the partisan Minister of Heritage, it is a elite group of legal academics who are not representative of a diversity of viewpoints. It's basically a hit list of progressive liberal social justice activists. Some of them, if you look up their Twitter feeds, it's just like a pure fire hose of anti-Israel propaganda. So we're talking about the pretty progressive wing of the legal community that gets appointed to this. And so that's in itself going to tilt the perspective of what cases get funded. It means you're going to have funding for progressive causes rather than conservative ones, even though, in my opinion, none of these cases should be funded. So I think what you need to think about is, can we realistically expect this program to fund challenges of things like, you know, the proposed Online Harms Act? I think given the nature of the people who are involved in these committees, who are drawn from human rights law, some of them are on human rights commissions. So, like, these are people who fundamentally support the aims of Bill C-63. I think it's highly unlikely that a test case challenging the Online Harms Act, I think it's highly unlikely that these people drawn from human rights law would fund a case challenging it. In any event, look, there's just no need for the program. It's diverting scarce taxpayer dollars to suing the government. And suing the government is something that organizations like us do best. Like, we are going to do a way better job of suing the government than the government is going to do. one of the most important pieces of constitutional litigation in the past decade, I would assert, is our judicial review of the Trudeau government's invocation of the Emergencies Act, which found that that invocation was illegal and unconstitutional. We brought that piece of litigation. We received no funding for that judicial review from the Court Challenges Program. We don't receive funding for other cases like that successful challenge to the Federal Elections Act that Joanna just mentioned, or any of our other pieces of successful litigation or unsuccessful litigation. We just don't need government money to do the work that we do so well. I actually think that if we're going to spend taxpayer dollars on, you know, an access to justice issue, maybe there should be funding put into the courts to help address delays in the judicial system, like the fact that we couldn't get a hearing in Alberta for almost 2 years. Like that, like funding the courts would do a lot more to address access to justice issues and constitutional rights that are being violated than this court challenges program that has the partisan selection of specific lawsuits. That's my headline, which is a big opinion in addition to a headline. But Josh, what do you think of the program? No spoilers for what you're going to say at committee this week, but maybe okay. Some high-level reaction.
She's going to have her popcorn ready.
Yeah, I mean, I only get 5 minutes, so I think you took like 10 or 15 there. But I won't give you a spoiler, but this morning I was going through the Toronto Star archives just trying to figure out what cases were actually funded, because like you say, very strangely, they don't want to tell us what cases they're funding. I wonder why that is. But if you go back decades, they did formally, you know, officially say like we gave $35,000 to this or to that. And in the Toronto Star, like every time they write about this, it's always liberals, like partisan liberals saying, this program is the greatest thing ever, and we need to fund all of these groups, like feminist groups or groups about disability rights or race or whatever. And it's always conservatives saying, no, the taxpayer funding should not be used to sue the government. People should just decide how to spend their own money and which cases to give their own money to. And this came to a head with Stephen Harper before he was prime minister. He was part of a group, National Citizens Coalition, that raised a ton of money to fight against Canada's electoral spending limits. And that's a big free speech issue, because you should be able to, you know, spend your own money to put forward your point of view on any issue. Like that shouldn't be limited at all. But so Harper raised all this money, his group, and then a couple of groups that didn't raise any money just went to the Government Court Challenges Program and said, oh, we need you to fund us so that we can fight against these private individuals who are giving their money to put forward their view of freedom of expression. And the decision in Harper in Canada is like one of the worst free expression decisions of all time. I won't get into it, but the funny thing is just reading the Toronto Star archives on this, like the Star loves the Court Challenges Program, the liberal paper, and the conservatives that get quoted every time absolutely hate it. And, you know, for us, like we're civil libertarians, we're not partisan in that same way, but it's just funny if one group thinks this is, one political party thinks this is a good idea all the time and the other doesn't. That tells you something about the bias mm-hmm. built into the program, right? So, Joanna, what are your thoughts?
Well, you may be happy to hear that it is not just, not all partisan liberals or even small L liberals are pro this program. I remember back when I was a baby clerk at the Court of Appeal, Peter Hogg, who was considered like probably the leading constitutional scholar, literally wrote the textbook that we all studied on constitutional law in Canada. He died in 2020. And I asked him this specifically. I was like, why would Parliament, why would the government fund litigants to go wind their way through the court system to challenge a law? Like, why wouldn't Parliament just repeal a law that it believed was unconstitutional?
Exactly.
And he agreed with me. He was like, yeah, it makes no sense. It's just like a peculiarity of Canada. He's from New Zealand. He was like, I don't know of any other jurisdiction that does this. I don't know if that's true or not.
There isn't any. No.
Yeah.
According to Brody, Canada is the only country that does it. And it does it because Trudeau wanted cover to oppose Bill 101 without publicly opposing Bill won.
Yeah. Anyway. And then just the last thing I'll say, good luck tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to watching
thank you.
But I was really glad that we didn't have to have any internal, when we got this invitation, when CCF was invited to testify at committee, that probably in other organizations, there would be some debate about, should we, you know, try and fix the bill? Like, should we propose, like, have a representative council that chooses the court challenges? Like, we seem to, even without even having to discuss it, just be on the same page that no, this is just a bad idea. Just kill the program.
No dirty government money for us.
But not just for us, but like we're philosophically opposed. And so we have to just draw a clear line. Because yeah, it would be tempting to, rather than me having to go out and fundraise and us having to do petitions and constantly have to ask you, our listeners, to donate to us, to just get a big, sweet chunk of cash from the government. But absolutely not. Never. Okay, with that, let's throw to break so you can get on our mailing list so we can ask you to donate money, and then we'll come back.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. Along with our new podcast, Not Reserving Judgment, it's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at thecccf.ca/freedomupdate.
Okay, so as of last week, we have a new, our like favorite Canadian law's favorite pastime is hand-wringing over the notwithstanding clause. And we have a new round of that following Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the opposition, made some comments in a scrum last week. And he said, and I quote, Justin Trudeau believes that it's all right for there to be concurrent sentences for a mass murderer who killed 6 innocent Muslims. He gets only 25 years. I think that's a disgrace. And then he said, when I'm prime minister, he will stay behind bars and he will only come out in a box. It will be consecutive sentences. So it'd be 6 life sentences. And we're going to make sure that it's jail, not bail. This is classic Poilievre, axe the tax, jail, not bail. It's going to be hard times for hard crimes. So, of course, everybody freaks out. And the national debate over the purpose and the legitimate use of the notwithstanding clause, section 33 of the charter, was ignited. So it's important to note that this is sort of new territory. Of course, nothing has happened yet. He hasn't formed government. But the federal government has never before invoked the notwithstanding clause. So this was bound to be controversial. And the comments also bring to surface a debate that's been happening in the legal community over the last few years, particularly as the notwithstanding clause has come back into vogue, between a group of legal scholars on one hand, who see the notwithstanding clause as totally overriding rights, and therefore being probably illegitimate in most cases. And people like our friend Leonid Sirota and the Globe pundit Andrew Coyne are definitely in this camp. And then a group on the other side who believe that Section 33 allows legislatures to express disagreement with courts about the content and extent of rights. And therefore, it is legitimate. It is part of the Constitution. And so it's lawful, and it's not appropriate to say that this is totally eviscerating the content of laws. And we think, we've talked about this internally a lot, that this is really just the first rumblings of a major showdown that is bound to happen in the next few years in this sort of standoff that seems to be between courts on the one hand, who are increasingly empowered to wading in and seeing themselves as having the last word on very divisive society-wide dilemmas like preferred gender pronouns for children, drug use, safe or so-called safer supply, and of course, crime, which is where it popped up in this case over what the content of cruel and unusual punishment is. And so courts or legislature, who gets the last word? So, two of the scholars that are in the, I would say, pro notwithstanding clause camp, not that they are unreservedly in favor of its use in all circumstances, are our friends, Jeff Sigalette, who's at UBC Okanagan, and he has the Center for Constitutional Studies there, Dwight Newman of the University of Saskatchewan, and they talk about Section 33 is facilitating what they call a dialogue theory. So it's a dialogue between Parliament and the courts about the content of rights. And they also point out that the notwithstanding clause was not just added as an afterthought to the charter. It was really, it would have been a deal breaker for it not to be included, particularly for the Prairie Premiers. And so invoking the notwithstanding clause really just properly reflects the different institutional capacities of the state. So while someone like an appellate judge will have particular expertise in applying legal precedent and following stare decisis and, you know, abstract exegesis of the demands of rights, obviously parliamentarians are much closer to the community. They represent constituents. So I actually think that this current debate, so the case that Polyev was referring to in his Scrum comments were concerning Alexander Bissonnette, who was, of course, the then 27-year-old man who tragically and in cold blood killed six Muslims at prayer in a mosque in Quebec City. And the question is, what does the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, which is guaranteed under Section 12 of the Charter, what does that require? And so we know that capital punishment is out, and there seems to be relative consensus in this country about that deprivation of the essentials of life, certainly torture. Those are all cruel and unusual punishment. But six consecutive life sentences for taking six lives, which the Supreme Court unanimously held in their decision last year, would shock the moral conscience of Canadians and violated human dignity. That's a little bit less clear cut. A colleague of ours, Yuan Huizhou, wrote in The Spectator, he noted that had the judges spoken to an actual member of the Canadian public, they might well have found that the average person in the street understands why a murderer can well be given a 150-year sentence. So the last thing I'll just say about this is I'm not really surprised by Polyev's comments. There's no reason in principle or in practice that I can see why using the notwithstanding clause should be off limits for the federal government, whether you think it's good or not. I think it should be approached extremely cautiously, because while I do think the notwithstanding clause is a rightful part of our constitution, and I also do think that judges are not sages, they don't know everything, they certainly have their own institutional perspective, they are amongst the most privileged and cloistered members of Canadian society, and I don't think it's good that they become a super legislature. So I think it should be used cautiously, but I also don't see any reason why it should be strictly out of bounds for the federal government. So I think it's alarmist that the sort of usual chorus of pundits like Susan Delacour from the Toronto Star, after Polyev made these comments, called him exhibiting authoritarian behavior. I think that's alarmist, but it's going to be a very important debate as we look into what happens if the notwithstanding clause starts to be invoked regularly as a default. What if it's invoked preemptively before a court has even weighed in on the constitutionality of the law? So we don't have our position on all of that nailed down just yet. But Josh, what do you think? Polyev, a tyrant, and is he an authoritarian ruler?
No, I think using the Emergencies Act against the truckers is a more authoritarian move than saying you're going to use it to disagree with the court, because the court says that someone who murders six Muslims at their mosque should be able to have a parole hearing instead of staying in jail for the rest of his life, which I think the vast majority of Canadians would think is not cruel and unusual punishment. And that's the thing, like, it's a very powerful tool, and courts are well placed to figure out the extent of rights in a lot of cases, but there are cases where they just get it really badly wrong, and there needs to be some way to correct that. And one of the good things about the notwithstanding clause is it can only be invoked for 5 years at a time. So that means if Polyev disagrees with the court and says, no, I'm going to pass a law to I don't know, reinstate consecutive sentences, or I'm going to pass a law that says, you know, the court says this mandatory minimum of, you know, 6 months for child luring or whatever is a cruel and unusual punishment, and we don't think so. We think people should go to jail for at least 6 months for that. If the voters disagree with that, they can vote in a new government in 5 years. And the preemptive question is really important, because if you use the notwithstanding clause preemptively on every piece of legislation, like, we wouldn't have any rights at all, really, right? So I think it's a tool we have to be really cautious of, and we should be skeptical of preemptive use especially, but it's certainly part of the charter, it's part of the deal. And I think some of the reactions are a little over the top. Christine?
I mean, there's so much to say on the notwithstanding clause. I could, and I don't want to take over and like go on forever about the notwithstanding clause. I will say a couple of things. First, the characterization that the media has of the use of the notwithstanding clause, which is they're going to violate the Constitution. It always ignores the fact that this is a part of our Constitution. It was a part of the bargain of the Charter. It's there. Like, it is not unconstitutional to use Section 33. So that's like one of my gripes that I always have about the media's portrayal of the use of the Section 33 mechanism. That said, like, I have really mixed feelings on Section 33. I'm very skeptical of empowering the government to override rights. On the other hand, I do think there's a big problem with the judiciary creating these untenable rulings that are so wrong at their core. And there's this whole theory, dialogue theory, that this is an important mechanism so that the legislature and parliament, which is supreme, gets to respond using Section 33 to wrong, what they view as wrong decisions. And then that dialogue is a part of our democratic process. So I'm reading an exceptional book right now that's put together by Peter Bureau on the notwithstanding clause. I'm going to have Peter and a few of the authors from that book on my television program, Canadian Justice, in a couple of weeks. So in my opinion, and I've said this to both of you, a couple of times, I think that Section 33 is the biggest fight in law among legal intellectuals that we have on the 10-year horizon. I think there's a lot that the feds have never invoked it. The first time it's invoked, it's going to be a big earth-changing moment in Canada. And I think that that is coming. I think there's a fight on the horizon over this, and we're all going to have to brush up on Section 33 and figure out where we stand, because
we're brushed up, right? It's just brushed up. Yeah, we're brushed up and see what they actually do. Like, I just think trying to come up with a grand theory of every eventuality is there.
Because my support of its use, it's like, I don't know, maybe I was telling Joanna this morning in Ottawa, like, is shooting bad? Are guns bad? Like, sometimes guns are bad, and sometimes it's good to shoot a gun. So it all depends.
Some people that we won't name just want to shoot the gun all the time.
Yeah. Like, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. And like, you can't just come out and be like, I'm for this or I'm against it. You have to make the case for when and why you're doing something with a really powerful tool like Section 33. It's not an invalid thing to do, to use Section 33. It is part of our Constitution. But let's turn now to something a little lighter, our bad legal takes. I will go first. My bad legal take this week, it's like so delightful for me. I'm like so excited about this one. It's from YouTube. And here is the context that led up to this YouTube comment. Last night, as we've mentioned a few times, Joanna and I were in Ottawa for the Politics in the Pen Gala, which is a black tie gala at the Chateau Laurier, where Canadian authors are honored and the winner of the Shaughnessy Cohen Prize for Political Writing is announced. And Joanna and I were invited to be table hosts as authors of Pandemic Panic. And everyone at our tables were given copies of our book. There were maybe like 1,000 people at this event. And as I said, it is black tie. So as table hosts, we were like, we're all in, like we're going full black tie. So we dressed up in pretty extravagant outfits. So I'm going to paint a picture because this is audio on podcast. So I was in a floor length silk gown that is this luminescent silk in blood red, blood orange red. And it had this super high slit. It had long, full sleeves, a collar. It was cut down to my navel, which is very provocative, and secured in place with a huge amount of double-sided tape. And under the dress, I had this elaborate body chain. It's actually ridiculous that I even own a piece of clothing like this. It's a runway dress from the Canadian designer Mikhail Kale, who is a conceptual designer. He's been called the Dark Prince of Canadian fashion. So it's like, it's weird that I even own this, but I'm like, hey, if I have this, I'm going to bust it out. When do I get to wear black tie? So that's what I picked. And then Joanna wore a dress from the designer Self Portrait, and it had this sort of holographic, the color is orange, holographic with sequins. And then it had an off the shoulder neckline with like a plunging V. So all of this is to say, in a lot of words, that we were like fashion, all fashion, and like a lot of skin, a lot of cleavage. And this is a lot for the Laurentian elites in Ottawa. But you know what? Joanna and I, if you listen to the podcast, you know that we are not go with the flow people. We are different, and we have an opportunity to make a statement, and we're going
to
make it.
We came to slay.
Yeah, we came to slay, and we did. We looked amazing, like so good. We got so many compliments. Like Joanna, when you were leaving, a man was like, "You are stunning." Like, just like, you know, I could eat it up, love it. But I also, you know, like they were provocative. They made a statement. And if no one had been offended, it means we weren't not going hard enough. So I am happy to report that someone was offended. And I'm even happier that their offense took the form of a bad legal take. So I'm going to give you the bad legal take. It comes from our friend Robert on YouTube. And I have to lead with saying that I love our YouTube subscribers, including Robert, even though I'm giving Robert our bad legal take. And part of this is because even when they're mean, they're still like praising you and nice. So let me read you Robert's take. He says, "I guess I'm officially old, but why do women feel the need to show off as much skin as they do without being charged with indecent exposure? You are beautiful and intelligent women. You don't need to objectify yourselves. It takes away from who you really are. Keep up the good work you're doing for Canada." Like, oh my gosh, I love this. This is almost exactly what my dad would say if he saw me in that dress, except I would never let him see me in this dress because he would say he would not like it. He would hate it.
Does your dad not have you on LinkedIn?
No, my dad does not have any social media. So Robert, I am sorry that you did not like our dresses. We knew that not everybody loves our style all the time. But I have to give you the BLT because cleavage is not criminal indecent exposure. There is a criminal offense of nudity. It's under section 174 sub 1 of the criminal code. That it's almost never prosecuted, by the way. And it is illegal to be nude in a public place without lawful excuse. And the criminal code defines nudity as being clad to offend against public decency or order, which perhaps Robert's decency was offended. And you don't need to be completely naked to be charged. But cleavage just does not meet the standard, even if it's a lot of cleavage. Mine did not meet it, neither did Joanna's. And I feel like we don't even need to take this analysis further, but I'm going to just like hammer it home because I go hard and don't stop. There is a 1996 Court of Appeal case in Ontario that found that a lower court had made a mistake in finding a woman guilty of committing indecent exposure after she walked on a city street and sat on her porch topless. And as provocative as our dresses were, they were not like topless. So they were a step back from that. And if it's not indecent exposure to be like fully topless, like our dresses definitely don't meet the standard. So Robert, I'm sorry that you did not like my dress or Joanna's dress this time. I had to give you the bad legal take because it's really funny. But I do appreciate your overall positive attitude and your support for our work. So thanks. Thanks, Robert. Joanna, how about you?
Okay, mine will be snappier. Mine goes to, well, snappy, a bit of a pun. It goes to a convicted sex offender in Norway who is asking the Supreme Court of Norway to declare. The headline in the news was that social media access is a human right, but actually the story is he's declaring that blocking him from Snapchat violates his human rights. And as background, he was sentenced to prison for molesting a minor and using Snapchat to target and connect with young boys. And so he wasn't blocked from the internet or from social media. He was just blocked from using Snapchat because he specifically used Snapchat to commit crimes against children. Snapchat, I'm told, is very popular with the youths. So the state already defended against a lower court appeal of this order. And the court found that the Snapchat ban was proportionately measured against the fact that the defendant has used Snapchat to exploit children sexually. And the court added he still has the right to use other social media. And it's speculated that if the Norwegian Supreme Court upholds the decision, this offender might go all the way to the European Court of Human Rights to reinstate his Snapchat access. I know the European Court of Human Rights has some crazy expansionist jurisprudence, but I'm pretty sure they will smack this down. So look, I can entertain discussion of a right to internet access, but certainly not a right to social media, and certainly not a right to a specific privately owned social media platform that was used materially in the commission of a crime. And in fact, I'd expect that even if the Norwegian state wasn't going to impose this ban as part of his sentence, Snapchat itself would be duty bound to ban him from the platform, which actually, if he was smarter, he would have just kept quiet about this and like started an anon account. Because I don't really see that the broader principle of getting access to Snapchat when you use Snapchat to lure children is going to garner much sympathy or anything good in the way of precedent for human rights jurisprudence. So I'm sorry, but very bad legal take. Norwegian Snapchat offender. Josh, what's your bad legal take?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to be able to top cleavage and pedophiles being banned from Snapchat being a human right, but I'll try. So mine goes to three different people this week. Glex Gill, who's a Montreal-based litigator, Richard Moon, who's a freedom of expression scholar, and Tony Keller, who's a Globe and Mail columnist. Now, this little saga started when Tony wrote a column about the anti-Israel encampment at the University of Toronto, and he wrote, "Do you think Israel is a criminal apartheid state, that the land from the river to the sea, which includes the entire territory of Israel, should be liberated, that Israel should not exist? I don't agree, but again, that's not legally relevant. In Canada, you have the right to express almost any and every idea. Want to march through town carrying banners calling for divestment from Israel or the opposite? I'll defend your right either way. But if you park yourself in the middle of a private or public space, set up an encampment, and then refuse to leave, quote, until our demands are met," and then he goes on to say, you know, that's not free speech. Occupations are not free speech. So this prompted Professor Moon to tweet, "This comes as a surprise to me. It's debatable whether the Charter of Rights applies to protests on campus. But there's little debate about whether occupations count as expression. The only issue is whether they can be limited." And Ms. Gill then quote tweeted Mr. Moon, and she said, "We evaluate charter applicability in relation to state action that restricts it, so it's not even debatable that the charter applies." So I think all three of them are wrong in different ways, but we can kind of blame the Supreme Court for that, because the freedom of expression test is actually horrendously confusing and quite muddled at this point. So Keller is in one sense wrong that an occupation is not expression. In one sense, it is. According to the Supreme Court case that created the test for what counts as expression, which is Irwin Toy, the majority said that all nonviolent acts intended to convey meaning are expression. For example, parking your car at a particular spot can be expression, and that counts a lot like, or that sounds a lot like an occupation. And when this was looked at in the Occupy Wall Street case, where people were camped overnight in St. James Park in Toronto, again, they found that it was expression. But there's actually no good reason why violence, first of all, can't be expression. But the court said it wasn't protected because violence undermines the values underlying freedom of expression. And this is where things started to go off the rails. So the Irwin Toy test is pretty useless because it means that every action is expression, except, you know, a punch in the face or stabbing someone. And the court eventually realized that, and they said, you have to consider whether expression is in a particular location is protected or not. And they did that first in a case called Committee for the Commonwealth of Canada. They split a bunch of ways. It was totally unclear. And then things got cleaned up a little bit in a case called Montreal City in 2005, when the Supreme Court said expression is excluded from 2B protection if the method or location conflicts with the values underlining 2B. So what does it mean for a location to conflict with those values? Only the Supreme Court seems to know, but at least Montreal City clarified that we need to consider the historical or actual use of the place to determine whether speech in that location is protected. So on the one hand, we have a test that says all forms of speech are protected except a punch in the face, but the test also says that expression is excluded where its method and location removes protection. And so this is where I think Moon got it wrong, because he's correct that, you know, an occupation is expression in the sense that Irwin Toy says everything's expression, but I don't think the only question is whether that can be limited. There's also the very obvious question from Montreal City about whether occupations are the sort of protection that 2B of the Charter exists to protect, which is more in line with what Keller's saying. So to me, this Montreal City test makes a lot more sense, because I don't think everything you do counts as protected expression. Free expression is about freedom from censorship by government, and it's necessary to self-govern and to exist as a democracy. And it does exclude expression based on some methods and locations, most obviously private property. So the fact that expression on private property is excluded seems to be so obvious that the Supreme Court judges don't explicitly say that, but they do quite clearly imply it in Montreal City. And that's what brings me to Lex Gill and why she is wrong. She claims that it's not even debatable that the Charter applies to the encampment protests at U of T, but it really is debatable because the U of T campus is private property, and there's some support in the case law for Gill's view, but the better reading is that where there's a private actor like U of T telling students to get off my lawn and asking police to just enforce trespass laws, that probably wouldn't even bring Section 2B into play. So that's why all three of those people get my bad legal take for the week. And with that, it's the end of the show. So thank you for listening. Please go rate us and review us. And just a reminder, you can support our work by subscribing to the CCF's YouTube channel, by following us on Twitter, or by visiting our website, theccf.ca. The Canadian Constitution Foundation is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by your donations, so please click that blue donate button on our website if you can. Thanks for listening.